and welcome to the Fresh Heart podcast. My name is Zareen and I am a consultant cardiologist. On this podcast, we explore tools to refocus your energy and optimize your health without blame or judgment and with compassion. This episode is going to be slightly different. Today, I'm going to introduce Fresh Heart Spotlight, a new podcast starting early next year that will run alongside this one. Throughout my medical career, I've had the privilege of working with an incredible, diverse range of inspirational people. People you don't often hear from. These unsung heroes are working hard, making huge differences to their communities. They all have a unique journey and have learned valuable lessons along the way. Fresh Heart Spotlight will retell their stories. Today's podcast episode will bring you a flavour of what is to come. Today's guest is a true inspiration. Professor Shakeel Qureshi is an award-winning paediatric cardiologist who has dedicated his life to serving children born with heart abnormalities. He has saved the lives of countless children, both here and around the world. He's published over 170 papers, several reviews and book chapters. He has masterminded the development of keyhole procedures so that children avoid open heart surgery. He works tirelessly around the world on his mission, which is to reduce the knowledge gap between doctors in the NHS and their colleagues in poorer countries. Amongst his many awards, in 2004, he was awarded the Sitara-e-Imtiaz, the highest civil award by the Pakistan government for his services to medicine. He is involved in countless charities, including Chain of Hope, which provides life-saving surgery for children with cardiac disease around the world. On the 70th birthday of the NHS, Professor Qureshi was named as one of the 70 standout stars of the NHS. When he's not saving lives, he can be found spending quality time with his 8 grandchildren or on the golf course. But his journey has not been easy. Join us as he talks openly about the challenges he faced and how he overcame them. Please note, this episode was filmed before the pandemic. Welcome, Professor Qureshi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You've achieved so much in your life and you're a real inspiration to all of us. But when you read a biography out, you miss out on so much. You never really appreciate what's gone on behind the scenes. And that's the journey that I want to talk about today. So if it's okay with you, we'll start with your early years. So you were born on the Pakistan side of Kashmir. You initially came to the UK age 6, but then it wasn't until really the second time that you came back to the UK, age 11, to Rotherham, that you really remember the challenges that you faced, particularly in school. So can you tell us about that period?
The first time was relatively easy because I was around 6 years of age.
Yeah.
Having spent the first 5 years in Kashmir, yeah. Where other than remembering where we lived, and it was a small town in the mountains. When I came to Rotherham in the primary school, that I was the only Asian in the primary school, but at the age of 5-6 years, you don't notice any other issues. And I enjoyed a couple of years here. And then my parents decided to go back to Pakistan. And then we came back in 1964. Mm. And we moved to Rotherham. And I somehow managed to get a place in the grammar school at my father's persistence. And the first obvious thing when I started was that I was the only Asian in the grammar school. Mm. And it took some time for me to work out what was being said or done, which is easier to recognize nowadays, but at that time it took a while longer. But it was some clear instances of racism, verbal bullying rather than physical, and racial discrimination. So I can remember those instances, which in retrospect are easier to work out what they were. And that then started making me feel ill at ease.
Absolutely.
And worry about the schooling there. But I persisted because my father used to tell me, well, you just have to work harder and prove to everybody else that you're better than them.
I mean, at a time when, you know, racism was quite rampant in Britain, you know, when was it, 1968, with the Rivers of Blood speech and all, and, you know, lots of tensions. How did you navigate that? And did you have allies at the time?
So in the grammar school, there were small numbers. I wouldn't say it was majority of school kids in my class or other classes that were racist, but there were a few. What used to then happen was there was another group of children who were actually supportive of me, and they used to say, well, ignore those guys, don't worry, you know, you're doing well, and so on. So they were actually more supportive. And so that was, in a way, encouraging. And I can remember the Enoch Powell speech as well, Rivers of Blood, because the day after, these, I would call them racist children, used to call me all sorts of names following that speech in particular. It became much, much louder than it used to be.
And you didn't talk to your siblings about this, is that correct? And you didn't tell your parents, or did you?
No, I didn't. I really didn't want to burden my parents. My father was a working class and earning limited amount of money, and so, and we were not well off. My mother was a housewife. My siblings were younger than me, so in a way I was protecting everybody else from what was going on. I didn't want my father to be worried about anything, and certainly not my siblings to focus on that side. I wanted them to carry on and study at school themselves as well.
What then sort of drove you to give of yourself despite all the things that you experienced?
In the grammar school, the teachers were brilliant in supporting me and pushing me, including the headmaster. And then our grammar school became a sixth form college. And the principal of the sixth form college in the second year told me that I was not going to succeed when I said I was wanting to be a doctor.
Goodness. And now you're incredibly successful. And, you know, you're in fact a leading voice in your profession and in your field. But it wasn't easy for you, was it? You had difficulty getting jobs as a trainee doctor. Can you tell us about that period of your life?
Well, in the I studied at Manchester Medical School. And maybe I needed that sort of stimulus, like the sixth form college principal. But even in the medical school, the dean on one occasion asked me what I wanted to do when I qualified. And I said, I was thinking of hospital medicine. I was still trying to work out what specialty to pick. And the dean said, well, there's no point in you doing hospital medicine. You won't succeed. You should go into general practice.
Right.
Now, it may be that he knew that because of that time, obstacles such as the color of the skin and you know, other things like that, he wanted to just stop me from finding out those things. But I thought, well, if the principal said that I was no good, and I've now proven to him, now I need to show the dean that I can succeed in hospital medicine. So I then picked adult cardiology as a career, and my house physician boss at that time used to encourage me. He was very good. He was an old-fashioned physician in a DGH. But
so he was your champion?
He was my champion in that he would say, oh, you will succeed, and then I would go back and say, I didn't get that job. And he said, you know something, I'm sure you were better than the other candidates, but I have to admit it may be the color of your skin.
Goodness.
And so, but he said, keep going. And so I applied for 13 different posts around London and failed. My boss used to say, well, you know, it's the colour of your skin. The former boss, the house physician consultant. And he would say, don't give up, just keep going. At some stage, you'll get there.
Okay.
And managed to get an SHO job in general medicine, which had a bit of cardiology with it.
And that was adult medicine?
That was all that, adult medicine. And then I thought, well, in order to get into cardiology, I have to now go for a cardiology registrar job. Physician with cardiology interest, adult cardiology, said, I've got my job as a registrar coming up in Barnet. Would you be interested in that? And I said, yes, of course. So he said, well, I'll let you know. So a month later, the job came up and I got that as a medical registrar with cardiology as an interest. Mm. And the benefit of that, and he again supported me and encouraged me, was that he was linked to Harefield Hospital. That's how I got into adult cardiology post at Harefield.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because you have had so much racism and you have had so much discrimination, yet there have been these champions who have just been with you throughout your story, haven't they?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So I think I needed several challenges. One was being told that I was not going to succeed.
Yes.
Or being told that I was not good.
Yeah.
So I needed that. Yet on the other side, somebody would recognize the possibility or the fact that I was actually committed and possibly good, and therefore they would support me.
Now, sort of sidestepping a little bit, you actually returned to Pakistan, didn't you, with all your family? How old were you at that point in time?
So that was, I was 31.
Yeah.
And I was training, this was, I was at Harefield Hospital still as a registrar in, by now I'd become interested in pediatric cardiology more than adult at Harefield. And so at that time at, in Pakistan, in the Army Hospital, Armed Forces Institute of Cardiology in Rawalpindi, the president at that time, President Ziaul-Huq, had a daughter with congenital heart disease who was treated in UK by Magdi Yaqub and used to come for follow-up at Harefield. And so the president decided that the AFIC, as it was called, Armed Forces Institute of Cardiology, should have a pediatric cardiology department. And so they were looking for a Pakistani trained doctor in the West that could set up pediatric cardiology. The only center in that at that time in Pakistan was in Karachi. And so I was approached and asked if I could think about doing this. And again, it was a challenge. And I then eventually accepted that I would go and try it for a few years. The intention was to actually move back permanently. So I uprooted my family, you know, wife and children, and we all moved to Rawalpindi. I was in the army as well as a major for for the time I was there, which was about 2.5 years. But then after 2.5 years, I decided to uproot the family again and move back to UK. Initially, it was all very good in that I was given a lot of support from the hospital, the chief, because they wanted a pediatric cardiology department set up so I could order equipment. And because it was an army hospital, it was funded very, very well. But again, I was slow in my perception of what challenges I could be faced with. And so the challenges were that having been brought up all my life in UK and not having seen large-scale corruption, I started seeing pretty large-scale and widespread corruption, not just in the army, to some extent, but when you used to order equipment, some of the distributors, who were obviously civilians, would try and encourage me to buy, when there were competitors, to buy a particular equipment on the hidden or partly hidden understanding that I would get some backhanders. And that made me even more uncomfortable, so I used to refuse. But then I thought, when various people used to say, well, you'll have to adjust to this, you'll have to do these things if you're going to survive for the rest of your life. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to survive here. And that then meant that I made another important decision about moving back to the UK. So I moved back. So those decisions about uprooting the family obviously had implications for the children's education. And for my wife as well. But and again, in a way, I now sometimes think that maybe I was too selfish in pursuing my high aims for my career. But it resulted in a lot of sacrifices for the family. And I, you know, that's one of the regrets again, that I perhaps made too many moves to uproot them.
Do you talk to them about it now?
To some extent, but I still, I think I have great difficulty in going through that, those episodes, because of the guilt, I suppose. Because I think if we'd stayed in one place, they might have done even better than they have. And therefore, I feel some guilt that I affected their lifestyle.
Identity is always a very difficult thing. It's very personal and it changes over time. But being sort of largely raised in Britain, going back to Pakistan, thinking I'm going to set up home here, and then coming back to the UK, did that have any impact on your sense of identity or sense of belonging?
There were lots of difficulties because when I was a child in UK going to school and then also in the medical school and then when I was into training, I thought, well, no matter what happens, it looks as if I'm still a foreigner in the UK, or even though I was brought up here. And then there was a weird feeling when I went back to Pakistan for the 2.5 years. I thought I'd expected myself to feel at home, comfortable. But then I started feeling this very strong feeling of being a foreigner in my own place of birth, in my own home country. And that was very weird. And that again, I thought, well, perhaps I should go back to a place where I'm still a foreigner, but I feel more comfortable. And that's how I came back.
And then you actually went back to Pakistan in 2005, didn't you, after the just tragic earthquake, which, you know, killed over 80,000 people, left approximately 4 million people homeless. Can you tell us about that?
So at the time when this earthquake happened, there was a... television here used to do a live transmission from Guy's Hospital of various areas of medicine, including ours. And so they used to do some filming of catheter lab procedures that I was doing. And then the earthquake happened, and it took me a day or so to think, because I kept thinking, it was in Kashmir, my sort of place of birth. The affected areas were a little bit further away, but still in Kashmir. And I kept thinking, how can I help? And what we were seeing on television was really devastating. It was terrible to see people affected. And I kept thinking, how can I help? And I thought, the only way I can help is they don't need a pediatric cardiologist. So I can go and do first aid type of work. And so I decided that I would go. And on the Monday, the BBC guys who were about to film, somebody mentioned that I was going to go back to Pakistan for an earthquake. So they decided to interview me. And I was interviewed why I was going, how I was going to do things. So I said, well, I'm just going as a first aid, relief work, or any other uses that they may find. And some of the other colleagues then said, oh, well, we'll come. There were two of them were from Kashmir. And then two other people, one medic and one non-medic, phoned me and said, oh, can we join you as well? And so suddenly we had a small team of relief workers and first aid type of people.
Yeah.
In fact, as it turned out, one was a pediatric surgeon, one was a urologist, one was a respiratory physician, one was a GP, and the other was a banker.
Oh, wow. And, that's a good skill set.
Yes. and the banker, I said, look, all these others are medics. And he said, well, I'll do a lot of digging and whatever or work is required. So I said, all right, well, come along. So we developed into a small team. And because that interview had been transmitted live, by the evening, I was getting calls from around UK, people saying, well, can we donate whatever we can?
Amazing.
And would you take it and distribute? So I said, fine.
Yeah.
So the funny thing was, when we arrived the next day at Heathrow Airport, the whole terminal was packed with people saying they were looking for Dr. Qureshi.
Oh, wow.
And so once I made myself known, they were giving me envelopes containing money that they'd raised. And then they started showing me boxes, containers of clothing, blankets, and then some medicines. And so there was the terminal full of boxes of equipment, relief work, clothing, blanket. And so I had to negotiate with the PIA, the Pakistan International Airlines station manager, about this, because there were only eight of us. And I said, well, you know, he said, you can't take all this as checked baggage. And so I said, well, it's your decision. This is for the earthquake. Plus, I said, oh, by then, by the way, the BBC had phoned and said, can we send a team of cameraman and producer with you to film this as well? So suddenly it became a possible documentary as well. And so I said to the station manager, it's your choice. You can either reject all this equipment, the boxes, or it could be filmed by BBC that you've been very generous. And so he said, okay.
Brilliant.
So that's how we got massive amount of cartons and equipment through. And so we went.
Were you quite prepared for what you saw? I don't think anyone could prepare themselves.
Because we knew that it had been hit. But when we arrived, there was nowhere, none of the buildings in the town were either stable, there were cracks everywhere, or that you could live in. But there was something odd that happened, and it's amazing how things do work out. On the flight from London to Islamabad, there was a politician who I got talking to, who wanted to know what we were doing, and I told him we were going for the earthquake relief efforts. And so he said, well, how are you getting there? And I said, well, we've got people who are sorting out transport for us at Islamabad, but the roads have been damaged, so I don't know how. And so he said, well, when you land, come and have bring your team to my house and have something to eat, and then I'll arrange a helicopter.
Amazing.
So we were then transported to Bagh by helicopter. And because he was an important politician, in Bagh, the army unit was alerted that he was going by helicopter. So the brigadier in charge of the army unit there was with his team, was ready to meet him. And when we got off, they were obviously giving him the protocol. And when we got off, he went off first with his other colleagues or friends. And the army brigadier and the rest of the team met him. And then we came off the helicopter and he pointed at us and me. And so we shook hands with the brigadier. And then there was a colonel who was next to him and asked me my name again. And I told him, Dr. Shakil Qureshi. And he said, were you in the army? And I said, yes, I was a major.
Mm.
And he said, you don't remember me? And so I said, no. And he said, well, you used to lecture me when I was at the Army Medical
Goodness.
College. And so we got talking, and then he said, where are you staying? And I said, well, I don't know.
Mm.
So he then said, well, there are no buildings, but you can sleep in our Army Field Hospital tents. So all of us then got these tents allocated to us, and he said, you can eat with our army unit. And so the BBC cameraman and the other journalists that were with us and our team, we were all housed in these tents.
That's amazing.
And the next day, we went to the field hospital because the main hospital had been damaged. And so instead of going for pure relief, first aid type of work, we found the field hospital where they needed some surgical help. So my surgical colleagues, pediatric surgeon and a urologist, started working with the Army Medical Corps doctors, and they were operating in the field hospital there.
Wow.
The respiratory physician and the GP, we then set up a camp on the outskirts of the town so that you could treat people and triage them. So the ones that needed surgery in the field hospital could be sent, and the others could get bandaging and whatever treatment, and then they could go home. And so I was doing that, and it became apparent somehow, I don't know why, but because I was distributing these cartons full of clothes and blankets as well, and the public that were affected by this, they were all gathering around, and so I was coordinating this distribution. Then within a day or so, I got a telephone call from the Red Crescent, which is the Emirates charity, and somebody from there asking me if I firstly asked my name, and I said yes, and secondly, could they send trucks full of clothes and food and tents, and could I coordinate their distribution? And I said, well, I'm no good at that. I'm not experienced at that. And they said, no, we've heard from a few people that you're doing some stuff there, and we don't know anybody else. So in the end, I said yes, and so trucks started arriving.
Wow.
And I was going to the truck sort of place.
Yeah.
And then the villagers were all gathered around me, and so I was asking which village they were from, and I would give them a truck, and then another village. And so I was finished up coordinating the relief efforts, for something that I wasn't trained to do.
Yeah.
But there didn't seem to be anybody else there at that time, because the UN and other charities started arriving when we were about to leave, rather than on the first few days. And so I was doing all that work. And then similar sort of thing happened in the field hospital as well, in that because of my previous army days, the Surgeon General of the Army Medical Corps of the Pakistan Army was a friend of mine, it turned out, who worked as a pediatric cardiac surgeon with me at the Army Hospital. And so at the field hospital, when they said, oh, we need an X-ray machine because nothing's working, everything else is broken, I would ring the Surgeon General. The BBC guys had a satellite phone.
Yeah.
So I would use that to ring the Surgeon General, because I managed to get his number.
Yeah.
And I would say, well, we need a X-ray machine at this field hospital. And he'd say, all right, I'll put it on a helicopter later today and you'll get it.
Goodness.
And so the Army Field Hospital doctors suddenly saw that I could coordinate things like that as well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a day or two later, they'd say, oh, the field hospital is packed.
Yeah.
We can't transfer these patients. We need to transfer these patients to Islamabad.
Yeah.
But we need ambulances, and we, you know, and so, so I rang the Surgeon General again, and I said, we need to, you know, there's 20 to 30 patients at least that we need to evacuate from here, and then more as time goes on. And he said, all right, I'll send a helicopter.
Wow.
So he sent a helicopter, and I said, right, guys, move these patients into the helicopter. Yeah. So the local field hospital, various officers started seeing, oh, this guy is able to coordinate this yeah. sort of thing as well. So I was then doing the coordination Goodness. Of that side of it as well. So I finished up doing something that I wasn't really trained for.
Yeah.
And it's just how, you know, just how things work out that I finished up doing more than two weeks of relief work that like that
Goodness.
Rather than what I'd actually gone to do, which was the first aid.
First aid.
And
wow.
this probably in retrospect turned out to yeah. be more
yeah.
invaluable sort of effort.
I know. It's amazing how you end up, you went to Pakistan for one reason and you ended up doing something totally different that was really unplanned, and that you just threw yourself into it.
The lesson there was that you can't, and it happens throughout life, you can't plan something and then expect that to actually happen. You have to be prepared for other things taking over, and a lot of it is fate, I think, isn't it? Because I'd actually gone out to Pakistan, to Kashmir, to do first aid relief work, finished up almost like a coordinating relief efforts, something that I wasn't trained to do. But during that period as well, because I was traveling around different districts and villages that were affected, distributing aid, I came across a lot of devastation, not just injuries, fractures, amputations, but also children of all ages whose parents had died during the earthquake.
Goodness.
And so that then became, somehow hit me that how those children were then going to be looked after in those villages in particular. And it wasn't just their parents, sometimes the whole family had been crushed in the buildings. And I, during that period, I really sort of lost control of my emotions, and I used to cry during that time.
Mm.
And when I came back, just the thought about what I'd seen affected me for months. But also, it had a positive impact as well, because when I came back, I thought, well, how can we help? So.
Yeah.
These colleagues that had gone out with me and some other friends then, we had decided that we would set up a charity. And we set up this charity, it was called For Peace of Mind. And then we had events, dinners, auctions, raised money. And we used that firstly to, it wasn't a massive charity, of course, it was a small charity. But we used that to build houses in Kashmir, in that area that we'd been to. We used that money also to then support the orphans in their education, day-to-day living, in training some of the teenagers so that they could have some skills which will help them earn a living in the future. Our aim became that if there was a natural disaster anywhere, then we would hold events and raise money. And so, as it happened, subsequently, with the tsunami, with various typhoons, our charity then held fundraising events, and we've built houses in Indonesia, in Burma, in Bangladesh, in Haiti. So, in the Philippines, wherever there were disasters,
yeah.
we were a small charity, But a lot of it was because of my medical contacts
yeah.
in those countries
yeah.
who I could then call upon to put us in touch with a local charity. So rather than go through yeah. governments and the big charities who also have to sort out their overheads,
yeah.
we were raising money, and all the money was then being used effectively 100% for the charity work.
And have you been back then since? Have you been back to those that region?
Yes, I have. And obviously, a lot of other charities from around the world had yeah. Contributed. There are still areas that have not really been dealt with completely. But the children that we've supported as orphans, and many of them have now gone through education, finished their schooling, and are earning a living as well. So there are some yeah. positive yeah. things to look at.
Yeah. How did you get involved in Chain of Hope?
What I was doing was, it was all through personal contacts,
yeah.
people that I would meet, make friends in conferences, who would then say, oh, can you help us with some this side of pediatric cardiology or some of the interventions, and so I was doing that. And then in the mid-90s, the charity Chain of Hope was set up, and this was set up by Magdi Yacoub, so we had that link from Harefield Hospital days. And he started initially focusing on surgical programs in really underdeveloped countries or countries where there was no service, especially in Africa, but also in other parts as well. And then, obviously, surgery isn't the only service that's needed. You need the diagnostics and, if possible, the interventions. And so it was the intervention side that I had the expertise in.
Yeah.
And so I then offered my services for helping to develop interventions in different countries. And so now the Chain of Hope charity undertakes missions in many countries in Africa, in Eastern Europe as well, and now more recently in West Indies, in Jamaica. Mm. So it raises money to build cardiac centers, raises money to treat children, and if they're complex, they're brought out of their countries to centers in the UK, centers in Europe, centers in Asia, for the surgery to be done or intervention. But also we undertake missions where teams go out, not just to do procedures, but also to train the local doctors, the local nurses, the local technicians, the physiologists, so that you can then develop a sustainable service within those countries. So it's, the aim isn't that work only happens when missions go out,
yeah.
but when we come back, the local teams can then do some of the simpler stuff
yeah.
and gradually over a period of years train themselves to doing more complex defects.
And have you seen that? Have you seen over time that centres have become
yes.
self-sufficient?
Yes, there are several yeah. centres in Uganda in particular
yeah.
and in Jamaica to some extent
yeah.
and so and Egypt for sure.
Yeah.
Where centres not only become self-sufficient, in Aswan in particular, they're now doing fantastic service and train doctors, nurses and technicians from other countries who can visit there.
Must make you feel good to kind of, you know, have a look and see what impact you've had.
Well, yes, it is good to see when things develop locally, but equally it does keep your feet on the ground, because these are very small percentage of countries or small percentage yeah. of cities where services are built
yeah.
in, let's, if we take Uganda or Ethiopia for example, you build a service in one city, the rest of the country has got absolutely nothing
yeah.
and so you then see, and I have seen patients who the parents with their children may travel for 10, 12 hours, sometimes even longer, on a bus in order to get to a center in order to get treatment. Mm. And so that then puts it in a different perspective that, yeah, you know, it's a battle that needs to carry on, and it's a battle that really does not get as much attention by all the rich governments, all the rich countries in the West, yeah, that it should.
Yeah. Now, we've touched on lots of things, and you've had a very varied career. What are your high points?
So the personal high points are succeeding in my specialty and achieving the sort of success that I sometimes think of myself as a six-year-old, five-year-old in Kashmir in a small town. If my parents had not made huge sacrifices to bring us to the UK, that I sometimes wonder what I could have been doing if I'd stayed in Kashmir or if I'd stayed in Pakistan. Mm. That's one. The other high point still linked to this is the fact that my father passed away in 1991, that at least he managed to see me succeed and become a pediatric cardiologist. And around that time, I'd started traveling around in these other countries, because he and my mother used to say, do not forget the poor. And that was a constant message: help everyone that you can think of, but also do not forget the poor. And so he managed to see some of that when I was traveling around before he passed away. So that to me is a huge consolation. My mother at least managed to see me succeed even more in the sort of things I was doing. And she always brought my feet back to the ground by saying that, you've got to remember the poor patients, the poor children, the poor families, and how you can help them.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you didn't spend as much family time as you would have wished to, and that you spend much more time now with your grandchildren than your children. How did that make you feel?
So, as I said earlier on, my biggest regret was not spending as much time with my children when they were growing up. And then when the grandchildren came along, I thought that they finished up. I think I'd probably do a lot more with them and spoil them more than I did with my own children. And it's probably, although grandparents do that anyway, probably overdo it. And that is probably in a way to make me myself feel better, that I'm compensating for what I didn't do earlier on. And the grandchildren are absolutely amazing, aren't they? Because there are times when I land at Heathrow Airport or Gatwick Airport from whatever trip, and I would ring, two, three, four of the grandchildren, and that feeling of talking to them used to make me so happy that I'd get home, and instead of saying, "I'm tired," I'd say, "Right," to my wife, "let's go to see the grandchildren."
Looking back now, what has been the most powerful part of your journey and why?
There are too many of those, but one good example is, and again, it's my parents who've put the idea in my head. So what happens is, whether it's a cardiology patient, whether it's somebody with other problems, somehow, if they contact me, whether they're friends, whether they're family, or complete strangers, if somebody rings me because somebody else has told them to contact me and they want advice, I somehow manage to put myself in either their shoes or their family's shoes, And then I go out of my way to try and say, right, I will contact so-and-so and I will contact so-and-so. That's the best person who will help you, but I will make sure they help you. And I try and see that particular pathway right to the end, even afterwards, and check with that patient or child that think whatever needed to happen had happened. Treating, dealing with patients of all types of problems as a medic, as a nurse or whatever is really essential, and we should be grateful to have the opportunity to do it. I don't say to myself, oh, I'm a great doctor, I've made this specialty into such and such. I actually think the specialty has been great to me. So it's the specialty that has made me what I am. That's the specialty that I has made me achieve things. It's the patients who have made me achieve these things. So I'm actually grateful to the specialty and therefore to the patients that have given me the opportunity to achieve things. That actually is one of the most powerful emotions when somebody from whether UK or any other country, far-flung country, contacts me and says, thank you very much for putting me in touch with so-and-so, they've done this and we're grateful. That is probably one of the biggest satisfactions, which takes me back to what my parents used to instill in me when I was a child.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your, you know, your journey. It's been wonderful speaking to you, and I've certainly been inspired, and I'm sure that others will be. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Qureshi.
Thank you very much, Zareen. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to thank Professor Qureshi for being so open and generous with his inspirational journey. He's a living example of the phrase, we rise when lifting others. If you have any suggestions, or if you'd like to share your personal story, please get in touch at Fresh Heart Project on Instagram, at Fresh Heart Proj on Twitter, or via the website freshheartproject.com. Remember, be kind to yourself, and small, sustainable steps lead to great change.
This podcast is produced by Lion Mountain Entertainment, a subsidiary of Morgan Archway Limited.